and revenge and getting your own back, as we would say, there is an extension of Christ's teaching in Romans 12. And can we look at some verses there before we turn to the Sermon on the Mount? Romans 12, verse 17 to the end, which is the classical passage on the whole business of getting your own back on someone who has wronged you. Romans 12 and 17. Repay no one evil for evil, but instead take thought. Stand still. Keep cool. Take thought for what is noble in the sight of all. If possible, so far as it depends upon you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, and I will repay, says the Lord. Leave it to me. No, if your enemy is hungry, well, feed him. If he's thirsty, give him drink. For by so doing, you will heap burning coals upon his head. Do not be overcome by evil, but overcome evil with good. And in Matthew chapter 5 and verse 38, the original passage from which all of that is a deduction, you have heard, said Jesus, that it was said in the Old Testament law, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone would sue you at law and take your coat, why, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to him who begs from you, and do not refuse him who would borrow from you. Amen. And God will bless the reading of his word and give us an understanding of it. Now, remember that from verse 21 of Matthew chapter 5, Jesus is working out the relationship between his teaching, the royal law of God, the law of the kingdom, and the Old Testament law of Moses. And Jesus is specially thinking about the way in which the Old Testament law of God had been twisted and perverted and misused and indeed misunderstood by the scribes and the Pharisees of his generation. And so Jesus sets up his teaching here in the Sermon on the Mount alongside the teaching of Moses and the Old Testament law. He never, of course, contradicts Moses or the teaching of the Old Testament. Jesus doesn't set the one over against the other as if they were contradictory. Instead, what he does is this. He takes the law of the Old Testament and he internalizes it and makes it a thing of the mind and the heart. You see, the scribes and the Pharisees had tended to externalize the law of God. And for them, religion was a matter of being seen to do certain things and perform certain rites and rituals. Religion, for them, was a question of performance. Just as many good church-going people today have long since abandoned true Christian convictions. And yet, although in their hearts they have abandoned Christian convictions, they still carry on with the performance of their religious duties. They still come to the kirk, and they still contribute to various works of mercy and charity and Christian causes and so on. It is an outward religion. They have externalized the teaching of the Bible. But Jesus takes the law of the Old Testament, and in the Sermon on the Mount, he internalizes it by plunging it into our hearts and making it an affair not of performance, but of motives and intentions. It's an inward thing. And he does this in the well-known phrase, "You have heard that it was said to the men of old, but I say unto you." Now, of course, he's not setting up his teaching against the teaching of the men of old. What he's doing is he is internalizing the teaching of the Old Testament. And he does this six times from Matthew 5 and 21 onwards. And on these six occasions, he touches on the sanctities of life, those areas of life and of living that are particularly precious to God, vulnerable areas of life, which cannot be breached without breaching the very life and the sanctity of God himself. And these are, so far, we've looked at, first of all, the sanctity of life itself, the question of murder, the sanctity of our emotional lives and loves and affections, the question of adultery. Thirdly, the sanctity of marriage, the question of divorce and remarriage. And fourthly, the sanctity of truth, the question of taking vows and oaths in the sight of God. And we come this evening at verse 38 to the sanctity of revenge. And the whole question of vengeance, taking the law into your own hands, getting your own back on someone who has wronged you, and leading your own personal vendetta against someone who has done something against you. You have heard that it was said in the Old Testament, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you that you do not resist one who is evil. But if anyone strikes you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. And if anyone sues you at law and takes your coat, let him have your cloak as well. And if anyone forces you to go 1 mile, then go with him 2 miles. And that law of Jesus is sometimes known as the Lex Talionis. The law of the Old Testament was Lex Talionis, tit for tat, this for that. And in the Old Testament scriptures, that law in its original form was given by God to control the unruly passions and the evil desires of men's hearts. In its original form, it was properly called justice. But when justice gets out of control, it is called vengeance. And it's absolutely essential to see the difference between justice and vengeance, running right through the teaching of Jesus here, the justice of God and the vengeance of man. Now, there are one or two things I'd like to say by way of introduction, and then we can look at the Old Testament teaching on justice and on vengeance. One or two things, three in fact, by way of introduction. You notice that in verse 39, you get these famous words, "I say to you, do not resist one who is evil." And that verse is often used by pacifists and is widely used by the pacifist movement in our generation to justify their position. And if you know anything about the claims of pacifists in our time, you'll know that they sometimes link these words of Jesus with words that Jesus spoke in the garden when he told Peter to put down his sword. And Jesus said, "Put down your sword, for those who live by the sword shall perish by the sword." And pacifists often say, well, there you are, you see. Jesus was a pacifist. He was against war. Those who live by the sword shall perish by the sword. But in fact, you can neither use that statement in the Garden of Gethsemane, nor this statement about not resisting evil in the Sermon on the Mount to justify pacifism. Jesus, in the Garden of Gethsemane, is simply making an ad hoc remark about Peter's use of the sword to fight for the kingdom of God. You see, in the garden, when Peter cut off the ear of Malchus, the slave of the high priest, he thought that he was somehow helping Jesus and bringing in the kingdom. Jesus is not making a pronouncement about war. Don't you think it would be ridiculous of Jesus to start speaking about the politics of war in the middle of the Garden of Gethsemane? Why should Jesus start thinking about war there? In fact, Jesus could never have made that kind of statement about war, since war has been used in history as an instrument of God for the punishment of the wicked over and over again. Particularly in the Old Testament, you read of God raising up the sword to punish his people. Babylon, Syria, Persia, the rod of my anger. And God raises up war to serve him in history. And I've always thought it rather strange that pacifists can go to the Bible and pick out verses that happen to suit themselves, when in fact there is in many pacifists a very strange aggression that has not been dealt with. Have you ever noticed that many pacifists are in fact very warlike and bellicose, sitting down on roads to block traffic and disrupt public life, tearing down wire fences at Greenham Common, those ladies ripping down wire fences in the name of pacifism, shouting abuse at the military in the name of peace. You know, they do remind me of the story of the lady who came across a minister's Bible once, and she was reading through all the annotations down the side, and she kept coming across the word slaw, S-L-A-W, S-L-A-W. And she said to the minister, "Why do you write this?" It was his sermon notes. "Why do you write S-L-A-W down the side of your sermon notes?" Well, he said, "It means, my dear, shout loud, argument weak." In other words, when he knew that he really was on thin ice, he shouted at the congregation in the hopes that the noise would hide the fact that his arguments were rather questionable. Well, my own suspicion is there's a fundamental weakness in the pacifist position. The center is soft. It's like one of these sugary sweeties. It's got a soft center. It's a flabby philosophy. And I don't think it's a philosophy that can be sustained by the teaching of Christ. And in fact, if civilizations and cultures had espoused pacifism as a Christian philosophy, then time and time again the world would have been overrun by countless tyrannies. It would have meant, for example, that Europe would have become Mohammedan in the Middle Ages if the Christian armies had not taken up the sword and in southern Spain put an end to the Moorish advance into Europe. The entire continent of Europe would have become Muslim. It would have meant that in the 1940s we would have knuckled down to German military socialism, and we would all have been Nazis tonight. Your children would be Nazis tonight. This church would probably be closed. Or at the end of the war, if Christian men had knuckled down, we would have allowed Russian communism to overrun Europe, and our civilization would have been engulfed by atheistic darkness. And so when Jesus says that we are not to resist evil in verse 39, he's not making a pronouncement on the politics of war. He is speaking about kingdom morality. He is speaking about personal, private morality, and not about war. The second thing to notice by way of introduction is this in verse 41. Verse 41 is a reference to the fact that Palestine was under the Roman Empire at the time, and it was the practice of Roman soldiers to commandeer the services of passing Jews and get the Jews to carry the baggage. For example, a Roman soldier might get hold of a Jewish lad and ask him, and indeed command him, to carry his military pack for a mile. And Jesus says, well, dear boy, don't just carry the soldier's pack for a mile. Offer to carry it 2 miles and watch the look on his face. Because there is nothing more disarming in the world than kindness you don't expect. Knock the wind out of his sails by going 2 miles. That's the meaning of verse 41. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, then go with him 2 miles. The third thing worth noticing by way of introduction is that verse 38, with its teaching of the Old Testament lex talionis, the eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, is not abrogated by verse 39, that you resist not evil. One strikes you in the cheek and so on. How could Jesus, in verse 39, be doing away with the Old Testament law in verse 38, when in fact in verses 17 to 19 he has said that he has not come to abolish the Old Testament law? 17. Do not think that I've come to abolish the law and the prophets. I've come not to abolish them, but to fill them to the full. For truly I say to you, till heaven and earth pass away, not an iota nor a dot — and these were little marks in the Hebrew alphabet — not an iota, not a dot will pass from the law until all is accomplished. Whoever then relaxes one of the least of these Old Testament commandments and teaches men so shall be called least in the kingdom of heaven. But he who does them and teaches them shall be called great in the kingdom of heaven. The real difference, and this is important, between verse 38 and verse 39 is this. Now, this is important. Listen. Verse 38 has to do with justice and judgment and fair play in society. Verse 38 has to do with judges and courts and sentences and law. And wherever this verse crops up in the Old Testament, and it crops up three times in the law of Moses, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth, the context is a court with a judge passing a sentence. And it's a rule for the judge. Eye for eye, tooth for tooth. It is a judicial verse. Verse 39. Do not resist one who is evil. Has to do with vengeance. Personal vengeance, revenge, vendettas. And how you react to evil men and evil situations and people who have wronged you. And you know, this is a fine distinction that is maintained right through the Bible from the very earliest appearance of vengeance in Genesis chapter 4, where you first find revenge in the Bible. God says, justice, yes. Vengeance? No. And I find it fascinating that the sin of vengeance, getting your own back, is something that appears in history very, very soon after the Garden of Eden. I'm sure that Sir Walter Scott was right when he said, vengeance is the sweetest morsel ever cooked in hell, because men treasure it and harbor it like Tam O'Shanter's wife, nursing her wrath to keep it warm, standing behind the door with a rolling pin, waiting till he came home. And she nursed her wrath. Revenge. That he was out having a good time. And she was at home. The sweetest morsel ever cooked in hell. And you find it in a man called Lamech. In Genesis 4. Let's just look at one or two scriptures. Oh, it's a great story, this. Wonderful. It's part of the Cain civilization, which you can see starts around Genesis 4, and God speaking from 13 onwards. Cain, God pronounces a curse on Cain. Verse 13, Cain said to the Lord, "Oh, my punishment is greater than I can bear." Have you ever wondered why God didn't kill Cain, when the rest of the Old Testament says that the penalty for murder is capital punishment? Why did the first murderer not die? Why wasn't Cain executed? Well, you see, Cain was allowed to live by God as a lesson to us on vengeance. No one was to be avenged on Cain except God. That's why Cain lived. 13, Cain said to the Lord, "Oh, my punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me this day away from the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden. I shall be a fugitive and a wanderer on the earth, and whoever finds me will slay me in vengeance." The Lord said to him, "Not so. You are to live as a lesson against vengeance. If anyone slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold by the Lord." And the Lord put a mark on Cain, lest anyone who came upon him should kill him. Then Cain went away from the presence of the Lord. What a start to a civilization. To go out of the presence of the Lord, that's not a very healthy thing to do, is it? Cain knew his wife. She conceived and bore Enoch. And he built a city. Not much wonder cities are filled with violence. You know, cities on the whole are places of despair. I'd read a book several years ago on the cities of America, and the book was called Cities of Night. Places of darkness. Not much wonder when the first city was built by the first murderer. Built a city, called the name of the city after the name of his son, you notice, not after the name of his God. God disappears, and you notice that from 18 onwards, the name of God disappears from the name of the family. E-L at the end of a name is the word, is the name of God. And so you see, it disappears. Enoch was born Irad. Irad was the father of Mehujael. There's the name of God. Mehujael, the father of Methusael. There's the name of God. Methusael was the father of Lamech, and the name of God disappears from the civilization. Then in verse 19, you've got polygamy, which is forbidden. In Genesis chapter 2, monogamy is the rule. Lamech took two wives. The name of the one was Ada, the name of the other Zillah. Ada bore Jabal. He was the father of those who live in tents and of cattle. His brother's name was Jubal. Oh, had I Jubal's lyre. Musician, you see. It's a pity that music first appears in the line of Cain. He was the father of all those who play the lyre and the pipe. Zillah bore Tubal-Cain. He was the forger of all instruments of bronze and iron with which to kill people. The sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah. Lamech said to his wives, the big boasting fellow, the big loudmouth that he was, Ada and Zillah, his wives, hear my voice. You wives of Lamech, hearken to what I say. Now here's vengeance. I have slain a man for wounding me. The man only scratched him. But Lamech killed him. Sweetest morsel ever cooked in hell. A young man I have slain for striking me. That's all the boy did. Strike him. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, truly Lamech, the big man, 77-fold. And it's to guard against personal vendettas like that that you find the law of God. Three places then where you get this Lex Talionis, Exodus chapter 21. You'll notice it's a judicial context, it's a court context. Exodus 21 and verse 22. A pregnant mother and two men are fighting and she gets hurt. Exodus 21, 22. When men strive together and hurt a woman with child so that their is a miscarriage, and yet no harm follows, the mother somehow lives, the one who hurt her shall be fined, according as the woman's husband shall lay upon him, and he shall pay as the judges determine. It's a court thing. And if any harm follows, if the woman dies because of the abortion, the miscarriage, if any harm follows, then you shall give life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. Why did God put this severe thing in his law? It was to prevent vengeance. Don't you see that? This is justice. It's not revenge. This is justice. Burn for burn. Wound for wound. Stripe for stripe. Leviticus 24 has it again. And really verse 18. Well, 17, Leviticus 24 and 18, still you see the Lord giving judicial rulings. 24 and 17, he who kills a man shall be put to death, because when you kill a man, you shatter the image of God in man. Man is made in the image of God. If you kill a man, you have broken the image of God. He who kills a man shall be put to death. He who kills a beast, not as important, shall make it good. Life for life. That's fair enough. When a man causes a disfigurement in his neighbor or an injury, as he has done, it shall be done to him. Now you see, it's not revenge. It's justice. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. As he has disfigured a man, he shall be disfigured. He who kills a beast must make it good. And he who kills a man shall be put to death. You shall have one law like this for the sojourner and one for the native Jew, for I am the Lord your God. And the third reference here is in Deuteronomy chapter 19 from verse 15. Again, it's a court context. Deuteronomy 19 and 15. A single witness shall not prevail against a man for any crime or for any wrong in connection with any offense that he has committed. Of course, it would be wrong if you convicted a man on the evidence of one other person. Any offense that he has committed, only on the evidence of two witnesses or of three witnesses, shall a charge be sustained. Well, that's fair enough. We must have honesty in law. If a malicious witness telling lies rises against a man to accuse him of wrongdoing, then both parties to the dispute shall appear before the Lord, before the priests and the judges. It's a court situation. It's justice who are in office in those days, and the judges shall inquire diligently. And if the witness is a false witness, you remember, of course, that this is how they tried to trap Jesus. If the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he had meant to do to his brother. And so you shall purge the evil from the midst of you, not by vengeance, but by justice. And the rest shall hear and fear, and shall never again commit any such evil among you. This is to be an exemplary thing. Pour encourager les autres, to encourage the others. It's to be an example. Your eye shall not pity. Justice is a very neutral thing. It shall be life for life, eye for eye, tooth for tooth, hand for hand, foot for foot. But you know, in the book of Proverbs, there are two places where we read about setting vengeance aside. They're very, very beautiful places. Proverbs chapter 20 and verse 22. It's a great art to learn this. You see, revenge is a terrible thing. It'll destroy you. Is there someone you don't like? So somebody who's hurt you, and you're treasuring your mind either what you would like to do to get your own back, or what you intend to do to get your own back. It will destroy you. It'll destroy you. Jean-Paul Richter said, revenge is barren. Its delight is murder, and its satiety, its fullness, is despair. Francis Bacon, the great Francis Bacon, said, a man who studies revenge keeps his own wounds green. You'll never heal the wounds by taking vengeance. They'll stay open. They'll be green. It'll destroy you. Proverbs 20 and 22. Oh, I think it takes a lifetime for us to learn this. Do not say, I will repay evil. Wait for the Lord, and He will help you. Isn't that lovely? That you bring Him into it. Wait for the Lord. He will help you. And over into 24, another beautiful verse of like intention. 24 and 29. Do not say, I will do to him as he has done to me. I will pay the man back for what he has done, because it'll destroy you. And you know, the really beautiful thing about this teaching on revenge and vengeance is that right through the Old Testament, you read that God doesn't just give us teaching on justice and revenge. God has also given us somewhere to run from His own vengeance. You know, there are three places in the Old Testament where you could run and be safe from the vengeance of God. Surely you know where they are. First of all, the cities of refuge in the Old Testament, all over the Holy Land when the Jews came in. God planted special cities. And He said, if you're on the run from vengeance, not from justice, you couldn't get away from justice, but you could escape the revenge of an enemy, there were these cities of refuge, and you could run there and be safe. The second place was, of course, the horns of the altar. They were a place of refuge and safety. And if you were on the run from vengeance, not from justice, there's no escape from justice, but from vengeance, you could run to the altar and hold the horns. No one could touch you. And the third place of refuge was the tent of your kinsman, or to give him his proper name, the tent of your kinsman redeemer. Have you not noticed in the Psalms how David speaks about God hiding him in his tabernacle? God's tent was a safe place because God was David's kinsman redeemer, his nearest relative who would stand up for him. And it was a place of refuge. And of course, it's the message of the gospel that God has furnished us in Christ with a place to run to and be safe from divine vengeance. Jesus, in His death, is a city of refuge for sinners. He is the horns of the altar for sinners. And if you hold on to Him, you'll be safe. Jesus is the tent of your Redeemer. And you can crawl into Him and be safe forever from the wrath of God. Here's a simple piece of practical advice. In a situation when you're tempted to take revenge or stick up for yourself or argue with someone who's attacking you, here's a practical piece of advice. I don't always take my own advice. I try. you take one step backwards. That's what you do. You learn to play the lamb rather than the lion. When someone attacks me unjustly, it would be easy to attack me justly, because there are many feelings. When somebody attacks me unjustly, I take one step backwards, and with the help of God, refuse to play the lion and stand up and fight. And instead, play the lamb. Don't you think that's how Jesus went to the cross? As a sheep before its shearers is dumb, so opened he not his mouth. And you'll find that one of two things will happen. Either the person who is against you will be converted and changed and turned just by you playing the lamb, or else evil will be destroyed. These are the only two possibilities. The man will be converted, or the evil will be destroyed. May God give us the strength and the grace so to live.